Hello and welcome to Saver, production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we have an interview for you.
Yes. We have so many interviews just stockpiled. I'm glad we're sharing them.
Yes, because some of them, this one in particular, are just so much like the voice of a person and a personality, and within them a part of a culture or subculture. And yes, this one is Mr. Dickie Brennan,
who we met in our trip to New Orleans, which also feels like, when was that?
Oh gosh, decades,
millennia. Who even knows?
No one was even alive then. the Brennan family collectively owns and operates 13 restaurants in New Orleans. They're a little bit of a dynasty.
Yes, and we spoke in our New Orleans episodes about how we got in touch with Dickie in particular, and like meeting him, and it was really great because it was just kind of comedy of errors.
Oh yeah, that turned out in the absolute best way possible.
Yes,
because we weren't looking to we thought that he was above our pay grade.
Yes,
and his publicist was just sort of like, our marketing human was just sort of like, oh yeah, no, you want to talk to Dickie? And we were like, sure.
And we got po' boys and fries and one of those. We were there for the bourbon thing. We got one of those too. So it was pretty good.
It was incredibly lovely. I was not expecting to eat that much, and then I ate everything. Mm-hmm. Hopefully there's not too many mouth noises in this interview.
Hopefully not. Hopefully not. And also, I believe he invited us to his house at Mardi Gras, and I haven't forgotten it is all I'm saying. So hope you're serious.
And he comes knocking on the door.
He's like, who are you?
Who are you?
How could you forget us?
Oh, I'm sure he strikes me as the kind of guy who doesn't forget a face or a name.
I agree.
Anyway, so yes, let us get to the interview. Picture it. We're on the interior balcony at a large table in Bourbon House in New Orleans, which is this grand, beautiful, decked out restaurant. And we've been in a crazy rush all morning trying to figure out how to actually get into the building. We finally get in.
Mm-hmm.
We, through a different entrance,
yes,
go up to a bartender at this relatively unrelated bar,
mm-hmm,
and say, we're so sorry. Do you know where Dickie Brennan might be? And he just points kind of languidly, mm-hmm, and says, why, he's sitting right over there.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, he was. So we're still in this headspace of like, where are we going? And then we get up to this like just beautiful empty place, and Dickie is so gracious. And this interview follows.
Hi, who are you?
I'm Dickie Brennan.
And
good morning.
Good morning. and you are the founder and owner of a restaurant group here in New Orleans, yeah?
You know,
founder of several restaurants. Sorry, go ahead.
25 years ago, I started a company, but I grew up in a family business, restaurant family. So, you know, my entire life has been involved in the restaurant world, food world. So,
what was it like growing up in and around your family's restaurants?
You know, we lived in this neighborhood called the Garden District.
Uh-huh.
And in the neighborhood, they had this restaurant called Commander's Palace. So Commander's is like the second oldest restaurant in New Orleans. So in 69, Mr. Morant passed away. My dad went to pay respects. We lived two blocks away from the restaurant. To Miss Moran, and she's like, I'm 80 years old. I don't want to run a restaurant. My kids, well, at the time, we had Brennan's down the French Quarter.
Uh-huh.
And my dad's like, well, we're in the restaurant business. We live in the neighborhood. If you want to sell it, let us know. So we bought Commander's Palace in 1969. So as a kid, are you kidding? This was like, you know, our playground, you know. So I was around 9 years old at the time. I can't recall a time in my life where I wasn't doing something around this wonderful restaurant that, you know, that was just a special part of my life.
When did you start cooking?
I guess, you know, at the restaurant, I might have been 12, 13 years old, and it was that summer. Paul Prudhomme was our chef, you know, and I guess maybe earlier, but in the professional kitchen, it was more around 12 or 13 that I actually got to participate, you know, in the professional kitchen, which was kind of neat.
But at home, you're making a divide. Had you always been in there?
So I love food. I mean, I'd come home from school and I'd scramble 6 eggs just as a snack to hold me over till dinner. So I was always cooking. Both of my grandmothers were phenomenal cooks. My mother's a great cook, but she was running around busy. So we had this wonderful woman that they're all over this city. These wonderful women that just can cook, you know, and they cook for families and babysit or just, it's like a second mother, you know. And I grew up with a woman called Mandy, and, you know, just, it was interesting when someone's cooking. So, I mean, I had so much opportunities to be around cooking as a kid, professionally, at home. I mean, it's all really part of the culture in New Orleans.
What kind of dishes do you remember from back then, from your childhood?
What's interesting is my dad would sit down early. We'd have dinner at the house, and then he'd walk 2 blocks to Commander's and go taste everything in the kitchen and eventually have a meal there. So we, you know, at home it was more home-cooked, whole recipes. It'd be red beans and rice with pickle pork, sweet pickle pork. I don't think many people nowadays experience pickle pork in their red beans, but, you know, as a kid, it was the protein, the meat that we would all fight over when we're having red beans and rice. Nowadays, everything's andouille sausage, you know, sausage in your red beans. Just a lot of chicken Creole, you know, just great smothered chicken, you know, with rice. I mean, we're Louisiana, so there was rice in a lot of our meals, you know, that you would have. So gumbo, I mean, it doesn't stop. There was always something coming out of a pot.
How has all of that influenced what y'all do at your restaurants?
You know, what I love about New Orleans, one, our climate, we can farm year-round. So there's always something coming in the season. So that played a lot of what you'd eat at home as well as what was on the restaurant menu. The other thing is we're at the mouth of the Mississippi River. It's the most fertile fish grounds in the world. So, I mean, we have so much a bounty of seafood, and it's all seasonal. And some of it's in the marsh, some of it's in the coastal waters, and a lot of it's inland. So, I mean, like when our blue crabs are going out of season, crawfish are coming in the season. So there's always something that's going to peak at different times of the year. And really, I mean, our philosophy in the restaurants, and it's the same thing at home, is we're eating what's in season, what's peaking. There's a lot of options there.
When did you know that you wanted to be part of the family business? Did you ever have a moment where you're like, nah, screw this, I'm going to...
None of us were encouraged to be in the business, you know, so there's no pressure to be in the business. I can't think of a time where I was like, screw this, I don't want to be in the business. I just was, you know, I say I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I grew up in just a hell of a time, in a hell of a location, with a hell of a family. I mentioned Commander's Palace when our family bought it in my earlier years. My dad and his brothers and sisters left Brennan's in the 70s, mid-70s. We decided to divide up the family business. And so when they moved into Commander's, Brennan's was their flagship. And Brennan's, you know, my dad worked Sunday breakfast because his older sister, Ella, wanted to work Saturdays because she loved entertaining. So he'd wake up and go to work, do 1,000 people for breakfast at Brennan's. I mean, it was our big signature dish. When we bought Commander's, if 20 people came by after church on a Sunday, that was a good crowd. So he's bored. He's like, I can't. Yeah. And he's like, I'm not doing breakfast at Brennan's. That restaurant, we'll leave it there. So we were somewhere on a trip, and we're eating, and there was a band out in the lobby playing some music, and we're having brunch. And he came home and said, I want to do a jazz brunch. And so he called Alvin Acorn, and a great trumpet player. And so three men showed up, and they roamed around the dining room. Paul Prudhon was the chef at the time. We did this great brunch menu. And, you know, I worked the first jazz brunch with my dad. You know, that was, you know, and to see where it is today, I mean, every restaurant city has jazz brunch.
Oh, right, yeah.
But I mean, to be able to participate with your family and watch them, you know, create something.
Yeah.
It's been so interesting. I mean, it's always something like that.
But and, you jazz, know, with them. And jazz brunches we were talking about. How does do you feel like there's like cross connections in between how a kitchen works and how those musicians work, like?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we always say cooking with jazz. I mean, you know, our seasonings here, I mean, we use a blend of seasonings, you know, and it's to really enhance the flavors, take something, makes it blossom. So, I mean, it's like making music. There's definitely a great correlation between making music and making food. I mean, it's, but we, you know, the other thing that happened in the 70s, Paul Prudhon was an American local guy, whereas a lot of the chefs were Europeans. And Paul knew all the farmer and fishermen. You know, he grew up in the country. So what started happening at Commander's early on in the 70s, we started doing local regional foods. 1981, Commander's turned 100 years old. And so there was this award that they would give fine dining restaurants around the country, the Holiday Awards. And it was always done in Chicago, an annual dinner, and people would receive the awards. All the restaurateurs around the country would go and meet. So we asked, could we host it in New Orleans this year and have everybody help us celebrate a restaurant being 100 years old in America? And so everyone, you know, so all these restaurateurs, chefs from around the country came to New Orleans. And I'll never forget the dinner. One of the courses was soft shell crabs, which it was the time of the year we didn't know if they were going to be busting out or not. So we had plan B if it wasn't going to be a soft shell. But it came from a certain farmer. We had squab. It was from a farmer in Mississippi. Everything on the menu, and we had it written, was what was the dish, where did it come from, who was raising it, and we had an American wine with each course. And this is 1981.
Yeah, that was before.
We had Duck on 78 Cabernet, which was his first vintage. It was cake bread. We had Callaway made a late harvest dessert wine called Sweet Nancy. So, I mean, everything was American. And we, that night, told all these restaurateurs, which basically back then, you were either Italian, French, German, if you were a fine dining restaurant. Most of them were in the downtowns. You know, they weren't neighborhood restaurants that we know today. And when that, the next year was the first American Regional Symposium, where people in America started saying, we're a regional American restaurant. We're not a French, German, or Italian restaurant. So, I mean, that dinner, God, look at the world we have today. I mean, it's classically trained American chefs. You know, institutes like CIA have given young Americans, men and women, the opportunity to become great chefs, you know. And so these things it wasn't an American food scene. It was, you were classically European trained. And then that just changed. I mean, in the 80s, it changed. We became American. We started educating. And so much of that happened at Commander's. And, you know, like I said, I can't believe I was sitting there as a young kid. I mean, that's where I started, you know, and it's never stopped the American food scene. So it's been a nice journey.
Yeah. It sounds like you, like, firsthand, personally witnessed Cajun and Creole cuisine go from being something that was really just cooked in homes or cooked in neighborhoods to a national trend and something that people respected. I mean, Prudhon, come on, like, how wild has that been?
You know, the creativity is really, I guess, when you mention Cajun or Creole. For so many generations, it was the same dish. There wasn't a lot of evolution. You know, red beans and rice was red beans and rice. Gumbo was gumbo. But with, in the last 20, 30 years, and it's, I really believe it's because young American men and women have gotten these formal educations, so they have this foundation to work from. And I just think in America, we're creative. You know, in a city like New Orleans is incredibly creative. I mean, my God, we created jazz. Prior to jazz, you had old world music. Everybody played a certain way. I mean, what happened in New Orleans, look how it's changed the world, you know, music. So this creativity, and that's what I love. It's hard for us to say this is a Creole or a Cajun dish because they've all, you know, the regional seasonal products, you know, in both cuisines, and now they're blended, you know, which is exciting because it's, food is always, should evolve. And it's just like us. I mean, I think my palate evolves over the years, you know, whether it's food, wine, spirits. I have, you know, my palate keeps changing. So it's nice to see food evolving at the same time. Jazz. Did I say jazz?
We have some more of our interview with Dickie for you. But first, we have a quick break for a word from our sponsor. We're back. Thank you, sponsor. Let's get back into the interview.
The name New Orleans is in more songs than any other city tenfold.
Really?
Huh. Mm. Because it inspired so many musicians. I mean, House of the Rising Sun. I mean,
oh,
so many
sure.
songs that you
yeah.
know.
Yes. Creation and tradition. Are you sort of a nerd for the cocktail history around here? Have you?
Yes. I don't know if I call it a nerd, but I'm passionate.
Hey, I think everyone's. Oh, go ahead.
I can't help it. I mean, my God, it's so much a part of how we New Orleanians live life. You know, and so it's a daily part of our culture is connecting with people, and the majority of that is connecting on a table with food. And how can you not have a great meal without spirits, wine? And it's such a rich tradition in this city, you know. I mean, being a part of creating a cocktail, you know, it goes way back, originated something like a cocktail. Just the bourbon, I mean, the way bourbon evolved, it was New Orleans at the time wasn't getting, you know, the brandy coming from the old world. So they knew they were making some whiskey up the river, and they said, send us some whiskey. Well, they didn't know how to ship it or whatever. They had to figure out how to take, which basically was White Dog, I mean, it was moonshine, and they had to figure out how to get it to New Orleans. And so they took these wooden kegs, and a lot of the kegs were used for things like nails, storage, that had rust. So they had to sanitize these wooden kegs, which they charred the inside. They put this White Dog in the keg, sent it down the river. Well, when it got here and they drank it, they sent word back up. They said, send us some more of the red whiskey. And they're like, what are they talking about? So, I mean, that's why we're sitting here in Bourbon House. You know, I grew up with a dad, and I think so many people drank the European spirits, the scotch, gins, vodkas. He just kept saying, it's American. Drink bourbon. It's American. You know, and that even goes back to the way we evolved the American theme for our restaurants back in the 70s and 80s. So, you know, and the other part of the story with the bourbon whiskey coming down here, they didn't send the barges back upriver then. So that most of the houses here, the foundations, are made from the wood off these barges. So the men that came down from Kentucky, and it was a great opportunity for them to make money, they get enough money, and it was the Spanish that brought horses to America. So New Orleans was Spanish occupied. I still don't know why we call it the French Quarter. It was built during Spanish occupation. But so they had the money and they would buy a horse. And there's a trail, it's the Natchez Trace. It goes from New Orleans to Louisville. And they would ride back up to go back home. And those horses are what seeded the horse industry in Kentucky. So New Orleans is a very interesting city when you study and you find out, you know, just all this stuff. So, you know, that's what I say. I mean, the food world is, it's interesting, it's creative, it's always evolving, it's living, it's growing. There's no better city to be in the food world than New Orleans. So I've never not thought of doing anything other than what we do.
So you've got bourbon coming in from Kentucky, you've got rum coming in from the Caribbean, and all kinds of other ingredients floating around. Other people are just kind of going like, oh, that's great. How did cocktail culture start here?
Going way back in time with the creation of a cocktail, I think it was just a part of the daily routine. You know, they were called coffee houses, and that's where you would take the break to go in and have a drink, you know, in the middle of the day or in the morning. You know, when I lived in France, if you'd go to the market early in the morning and you go into the coffee shops, someone might be having an espresso, but someone else is having a cocktail, you know, and then, you know, an absinthe or whatever. So I think a lot of that culture was here in the city, drinking. But what I love about today is it's like when in the 80s we started educating with culinary institutes. We now have a generation and they've gotten educated in the spirits world. Whether we call them mixologists, you know, not quite sure yet where we're going with the name, but they're professionals and they really can give a customer an experience that you didn't experience when you walked in and said, give me an old fashioned. You know, now it's, what bourbon would you like with your old fashioned? You know, and then the young mixologist saying, well, tell me kind of what do you like? You know, what do you like, sweet? Do you like bitter? You know, and picks the right rum or picks the right bourbon for you to have that great experience. So, I mean, it's, I don't know what it's going to look like in 10 years, but what's happened the last 10 years has been crazy, certainly in the spirits world.
Are there any drinks for which you're a traditionalist? Is there anything that you want the one way and that's the way that it should be? Or do you like riffs? Do you like that experimentation?
You know, there's some things that I don't want to mess with, like a Bloody Mary. You know, there's the original recipe, it's very basic. You know, great tomato juice, a little bit of a Worcestershire sauce, Tabasco, that's it. And I think when you make that drink and you drink it with a good vodka, it works. Nowadays, we're sticking so many things in it, and it gets too gritty because you're putting all these, too much pepper, too much, all, you know. That's, I'm like, don't mess with a good thing. Now, if you want to mess with it, call it something else. Because we certainly have created some great things from a Bloody Mary. So I'm all about the evolution of whatever, whether it's food, spirits, cocktails. I think that's the exciting part. And we've never been in a better time where the quality of the evolution of these drinks or whatever has been better. I mean, it's phenomenal what's going on right now.
Are there any evolutions from your places here that you're particularly proud of or excited about?
So, I grew up where we made a basic milk punch. And for years it was brandy milk punch. Then our family started doing bourbon milk punch. So I grew up with a very simple bourbon milk punch recipe. And when we opened up here on Bourbon Street, Bourbon House, this proliferation of daiquiri shops up and down the street, you know, and they're real sweet. I mean, not knocking them. And the fun thing about New Orleans, you can walk up and down the street with a cocktail. So we knew we wanted to do something to add to enhance, to be a little different. And so we created a frozen bourbon milk punch. It's, I call it an adult milkshake, because basically, you know, it's not what you would find in the daiquiris, you know, sweet. And all, it, I mean, this is, it's a custard that we freeze with bourbon and, you know, and it's really become one of our signature items. So it was a good evolution.
Oh, there's riffs on the frozen bourbon milk punch, too. Now we have the frozen bourbon milk punch, but we also have, at Mardi Gras, king cakes are really popular here. So we do the king cake bevy, which is the king cake version of the frozen bourbon milk punch.
What does that look like?
Well, we got, you know, on top of the king cakes, you have a little different color sugar, so we do a little bit of dusting. The one I really like is, you know, our family created Banana Foster. We have it, which is flambé with rum. So at Palace, where we feature rums, you know, we do a derivative of the bourbon milk punch, but it's a Banana Foster milk punch. And so it's flavored with bananas, some cinnamon, and the rum. But it's another one of these frozen drinks. So people really, the nice thing is you get to an end of a meal and you don't want to have a dessert. These drinks have become the go-to for a lot of our clientele. And being in the French Quarter, New Orleans, it's the ideal thing. You're finishing a meal, you don't really, and you can take it and go outside and see what's going on. There's a lot of interest in wanting to walk around the French Quarter. So our adult milkshakes have become very popular.
We just had that Banana Foster last night, by the way, and it was not the drink, but the whole thing. Yeah, it was, oh, it was so good. Do you have a favorite or perhaps a short list? I hate it when people ask me my favorite thing. I'm like, everything, literally everything I've ever tasted is my favorite. Do you have a favorite cocktail? Something that you just go back to all the time?
Maybe a Ramos Gin Fizz. I don't know why, but it's on the top of a bunch of, you know, I've always loved the breakfast drinks in New Orleans, you know, a great bourbon milk punch. A Sazerac, you know, is a wonderful, I put it more in the category of an aperitif, you know, it's something I want to enjoy before I'm going to have a meal. You know, and just the flavoring of it, you think of a Sazerac, my God, it's the whiskey, but then you rim the glass with, you know, Herb Saint is our local anise. Yeah, and then you're putting in these different bitters. I mean, there's so many ingredients in these bitters. They were created by pharmacists in New Orleans way back for medicinal purposes. But it was all food-based. The bitters are based from food products, spices. So, I mean, what's going on when you put all that with a great bourbon? You know, boom, that's, I mean, makes your mouth go, wow, what's going on in here? So I've been fortunate that I've always been able to enjoy, been exposed growing up in New Orleans to just some incredible spirits cocktails.
So you mentioned you were reviewing a restaurant in New York recently. What other things, besides all the stuff you're doing with this, what else are you involved in?
Our biggest thing we've been working on the last 5 years is a new culinary institute in downtown New Orleans. And I say culinary, but it's really, you know, we're going to start off this January with a baking and chef curriculum. But it's really an institute that we hope evolves in a lot more than just training chefs. So we say hospitality, we want to focus on the front of the house, service. And our real plan from day one when we found this incredible property, it's 100,000 square feet, it's a beautiful building right in downtown New Orleans, was to partner up with all the different universities in town. I mean, we don't want to recreate the wheel here, but we think our industry, you know, when I've made reference to the Institutes like Culinary Institute of America, what it started doing to help young Americans be classically trained, it's changed the food scene. You know, you had fine dining restaurants in the downtowns, then you had mom and pop's neighborhood restaurants. Our mom and pop neighborhood restaurants are at the same quality of a, you know, four-star restaurant that would have existed in a formal environment downtown. So that was education. And so this, the food industry is huge. I mean, we're the biggest employer behind the government. And it's just involves a lot of things. I mean, I don't want to ramble on. I could ramble on a lot about this institute.
We like rambling.
So when I say we want it to evolve, I'll use this as an example. There's no architecture school in America that has any concentration on food service design. Now, architects will give you a restaurant. They love to, but they'll ask you, who's doing your kitchen? And typically, it's the person that sells you the equipment. And they have the computers, and they put it on that, and they send it to the architect, and the architect stamps it. And it's a person who's selling certain brands is designing your kitchen. Our hope is that we can go to the next level to where there can be people that are trained in what is the ultimate kitchen. You know, we've got to evolve the equipment. You know, we just redid Palace Cafe's kitchen after 27 years. And next to each station that has traditional, which would be gas burning, we put in an induction range next to it, trying to get our young culinarians to learn how to cook on a different, but it's going to be, you know, it's what is going to be the future, best uses, best pieces of equipment, a lot of research development. So with Noki, you know, our idea is we don't want to start an architecture school. Tulane has an incredible one 2 miles up St. Charles Avenue. All they have to do is hire one teacher that knows food service design and create an MBA level for architects to go get this specialty to where they really know kitchens and put that under the Noki brand. So, I mean, it's one teacher teaching something that no one teaches, and it's because we've created this Noki Institute, which is about trying to create education to all different areas of the food world. I mean, you take Tulane and LSU medical schools. I mean, how much opportunity is there with tropical science school? Of food being part, the R&D of food going into medicine, going into healthcare. So really trying to create a new industry in New Orleans at higher education, but we want to focus on the food world. So it's endless what it can be. But no, we've always been involved in a lot of things. I mean, I grew up with parents that they would always say, you can't just be inside your four walls. You have to be a part of your community, be a part of your industry, you know, and get out there. So, I mean, my goodness, this town has so many great efforts going on and good causes, and, you know, it's hard to kind of list the things that I've been involved in over the years. We're going to do this 30-something years ago. We created a Louisiana Children's Museum in downtown, you know, in the warehouse district. And so the last year, they've been building a brand new facility in City Park, our municipal park. And so we're going to do the food service in the new Children's Museum, which is really exciting because also in City Park, you have another effort going on, Grow Dat. You know, we do Who Dat, so Grow Dat. And it's a farm, it's a working farm so that people can learn and be educated. So we're really excited about taking what we're doing in the museum with the kids. We've got the food, you know, the farming going on and what we can do together. It's gonna be a great project, you know, being able to work with the kids and educate them on where your food comes from and how to cook it. It's gonna be fun. So,
want to talk about
kind of what we're doing tomorrow, what we're doing for the oyster recycling.
Oh, right. Yeah, I was reading about this. You you helped institute a oyster shell recycling program.
Right. You know, I love fishing, and I'm going to, my cousin has a great fishing camp just about 30 minutes south of the city. And I'm driving down there one day, and where a lot of the oyster boats, you know, it's a commercial fishing village as well as recreational camps. There's this huge mound of limestone rock, and they've got a front loader that's scooping it up and putting it on an oyster lugger. So that when they're going out, they're rebuilding beds, because we have to move where the oysters are if we're going to do freshwater diversions to rebuild the marsh. And the biggest obstacle is, it's not fishermen catching fish and move around, it's the oyster farmers that have a lot of time invested in making a bed. So there are a lot of efforts to make beds in different areas so that we can bring fresh water in. And, but I'm like, there's no limestone in Louisiana. I don't know how far you got to go to find limestone. So I'm like, we're buying a product, we're shipping it here, and we're trying to rebuild beds. When we have, so we can grow oysters. All right, we have oyster shells that we throw away that go to the landfill for forever. And it's just, it makes no sense. So that kind of instigated, what can we do to recycle? How can we get these oyster shells as part of rebuilding the coast instead of letting them fill up our landfill? So it worked out. I mean, it's been a very successful. How many times? I mean, we're talking like 400,000 tons that we've recycled.
Miles and miles of new oyster reefs we've been able to build, which also replacing the barrier islands that we're losing. So they're serving a dual purpose. They're a new ground to raise additional oysters, but they're also helping in coastal erosion.
Right, so they can certainly build a bed, but we put them in these baskets. It's like a sleeve, you fill it up, you tie it. Then it goes inside a big crate so that these could be anchored. And they're like, looks like this table, and they're maybe this deep. And so our coastal erosion, that coastline, wherever it is in the marsh or what out on the, it just keeps eroding. So if you take this basket and you put it 10 yards in front of where the existing coast is and you anchor them in, it just naturally will fill, and instead of the erosion going in one direction, we build back the coastline. And that's what's worked really nice with this oyster recycling. So, I mean, because of that, we're making progress. So it's exciting. I mean, it's something we should do.
What's the food and drink community like around here? Like, what's it like? Not just you know, people coming in and enjoying things, obviously, but what's it like working with these farmers and these producers and other restaurants around town?
I mean, I feel sorry for people that do other stuff. I mean, to have to talk to a farmer or go out on a boat fishing and, you know, being outdoors and just seeing all these, understanding where it's coming from and then bring it into the restaurant. All these wonderful, talented people that want to cook, you know, and they want to see someone enjoy it. I don't know. I mean, I've never not enjoyed this experience, you know, the daily ritual of that food part. Now, trying to make the business work and looking at the payroll and all the other things, you know, that's not the fun part of the day, but the food part, the product part, you know, that this is in season, it just came in the back door, you know, then we get to prep it in a way that we can give it to someone and they really just have a great experience. That's good stuff. My dad always said what he liked about our business was people came to us to have a good time, you know, and you really help create memories for people, people together celebrating. As opposed to if I was a banker, people coming to me, they need money. If I'm an attorney, they're coming to me, they got a problem. Doctor, you're going because you're hurting. I mean, people come to us to have a good celebration. It's a real positive attribute.
We've got a bit more of this interview left, but first we're going to take one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And back to the interview.
What do you see coming in the future, other than this awesome institute? What do you hope for y'all and for New Orleans? And I guess what other problems are you working on tackling?
You know, one of my hopes with this new institute, Noki, it amazed me how many young men and women work in New Orleans restaurants, and they never get past the line cook position. They don't become that manager. They don't become the sous chef. And I'm convinced it's because they don't have that formal education. And a lot of these people aren't going to be able to leave state and go to a Johnson & Wales, a Culinary Institute, whatever. It's just not going to happen. So one of our biggest, from day one, mission with this new institute is we certainly want to take individuals that have been cooking for 15 years or whatever. I mean, they're in it, and they know what they're doing. They have great skills, very talented. But be able to put them in that classic environment where they, I say, learn a language. I mean, if you don't, you can make hollandaise as like a Michael Jordan playing basketball, but if you don't know the word emulsify and the chemistry behind what you do and why it works, I think it keeps you from having confidence, and that lack of confidence is where these men and women don't go to the next level. Because there's so many I've worked with over the years that I've said, "Come on, why don't you take a little responsibility?" No, I'm good doing what I'm doing. And then I've seen young men and women from out of state that have graduated from these wonderful programs, and so many of them go, "I want to cook in New Orleans." And so it's this young, confident, you know, someone just graduated from college school that's coming in, and they're getting the sous chef position, and then they become the chefs. I mean, I'm certainly not knocking Emil Lagasse, but I mean, couldn't be a greater example of, you know, Emil came in, started working with my family, and, you know, look where he's gone. So I really hope this institute, because in New Orleans, you know, we certainly have our challenges when it comes to, I'll just say it, it's race relationships. And a lot of people, leadership on both sides, when you're having a conversation, you know, a lot of time the leadership will say, "Well, I don't see anybody out of the African-American community being the chef or being the business owner." You know, at some point, you know, that has to evolve. And so I think this is an opportunity for our industry, instead of people being, you know, stuck and can't get to the next level, that this should open that door. And because we have the talent, it's like musicians. Our jazz musicians are worldwide. We have athletes that are just incredibly, probably have more of them in the NFL than anywhere. We have the same talent that can cook. They just don't have that education to where they're going to go be a chef. My hope is, in a short period of time, there'll be men and women out of this community that'll be a chef in New York City, the East Coast, the West Coast, and really changing that path that hadn't really been here in New Orleans.
Yeah.
So that's a big one.
Yeah.
But it would help New Orleans so much, you know. I mean, we're a wonderful city. We have so much going on for us. But I just, you know, my dream is it's a great city. And it's not a great city when, like we're saying, I mean, not every man and woman in this community has a path to really live the American dream. My family has lived the American dream. We had nothing, you know, and we worked hard, and we had a lot of good luck. We're Irish, you know, and good mentors, and we're educated. And it helped us live an American dream. So that's something I hope we can do for New Orleans.
Thank you. I guess, speaking of learning, is there anything that you feel like you're still learning personally?
Sorry, I didn't mean to get personal.
You know, I mean, you're just going through different stages in life. I mean, I have grown-up kids that are now, you know, getting educated, getting great, because they want to come into the family business. My nephew's already in the business working with us. So I'm kind of at this stage, and I grew up with, my dad was certainly this way. He didn't want to be an 80-year-old going to work telling everybody what to do. He wanted me to get educated so I could come back home and sit around with him and the team, and we'd talk about something, and I'd be able to go, we haven't tried this, or why are we doing that? Because I'd gotten educated, and that in a short period of time, the team would be going, Junior's not here because he's junior. Junior's here because he's got some skill and could become part of the leadership and the team. So we had these early transitions from a senior generation to the next generation of being able to run the business. And I really valued the time after I graduated from college when I went and worked outside the family before I came back. Value that. And to see it, to be on the other side where I'm now my dad watching my kids go get that exposure. And they're smart. They're doing better than I did with what their experiences are. But they're bringing it home. And so I'm looking forward to transitioning out of having to, you know, it's their turn. I want to be on the sideline. I want to help them. I want to be their, you know, their resource. Whatever they need, I want. But it's their turn to do it. So it's a wonderful part of my life. I mean, I'm freeing up. I don't have all the responsibilities, and I've got a great team that they don't need me to open a restaurant, close a restaurant, and so life's pretty good.
Yeah. Do more of that celebration.
That's where I can
here and there
live life.
Hmm. Yeah, is there anything you would like to speak to that we didn't ask you about? Or
all right, well, I'm going to do this.
Okay.
Just our philosophy. I mean, we have four restaurants, mm-hmm. and I mean, yeah. Bourbon House was when we first decided, let's focus on a spirit, and with all the history we've talked about with bourbon, it was, let's do the spirits here. Palace Cafe, more recently, we did a major renovation. We added a bar on the second level because we really didn't have a bar. And we decided to do rum. Now, I mean, rum, my God, hundreds of years ago, we started growing sugarcane in Louisiana. And it was the Jesuits, and one of the first areas that they grew sugarcane was right across Canal Street where Palace Cafe is. I mean, that's where they were growing. And I mean, sugar's what makes rum. So that was our connection with wanting to do that spirit. And then at the steakhouse, it's always, you know, been that classic old world spirits, the scotch, the rum, I mean, vodka, gin. But my family's Irish. So we have an Irish whiskey collection there just to pay some homage to our heritage. And it's a nice way that we can do it. And then, you know, our youngest. So we just recently added a martini cart.
Tableside martini.
So
service.
We go do tableside martinis. And, you know, this is what we keep saying. I don't want to change for the sake of change, but you got to evolve. You know, so there's a lot of fun for us trying to evolve things. And this is where you, instead of that martini just showing up, it's a whole different experience. I mean, you're looking at these incredible products that are going to garnish, that are the options to take your martini to another level. And a real trained professional that's making it perfect, the right temperature and the right glass. I mean, life's short. Let's eat, you know. Do it right. Eat good. And then, but our newest restaurant, Tableau, you know, it's in a part of the quarter where originally the French Quarter was built. It's right next to St. Louis Cathedral. You know, when they founded the city and decided this is where we're going to build the city, there was a priest there, and they said, build a church there. and it's the oldest cathedral in America, but it's where the city was developed. We're right next to it. A block behind it is the oldest ballroom in America, because we celebrate. We've always celebrated. So it's just that feeling of being around that area there. We do sparkling and champagne, you know, because it's where we should be celebrating. And it's part of Le Petit Theater, which is the oldest community theater in America. So it's about going to enjoy theater in this wonderful restaurant with a balcony and a courtyard, champagne, sparkling, kind of works in that environment. So I love the fact that we focus on something, and because each of our restaurants is totally different experiences, but it's just a matter of time before we can kind of find something that we can specialize in. So, it's been fun. I don't know what we're going to do at the Louisiana Children's Museum.
Got any ideas?
All ears.
Yeah, we were talking yesterday to Isaac Troop. They were talking about how New Orleans is different than many other places in the way that it treats alcohol and the way that it, you know, the way that kids are allowed to grow up around it rather than it being, you know, the kind of like Puritan thing. Has that been your experience?
You know, and I mean, let's, my experience in France, you certainly, you know, consuming wine and stuff like that at a table at home from an early age. I mean, I worked in kitchens where we would sit down and do our family meal before the service, and we certainly drank wine, you know. So I don't think it's just New Orleans, but I think New Orleanians, we live like, I'll never forget, he was one of the original anchormen, Brinkley, David Brinkley. So he was whatever channel. He had Cronkite, three of them did the nightly news. And he was a dear friend. He was in New Orleans all the time. And he was having dinner with my Aunt Ella and a handful of people. It was probably a Lindy Boggs, you know, wonderful group of characters. And Aunt Ella, the whole night, kept saying to him, you know, we can't get this right, and we're not, you know, it was all things that she was disappointed with the leadership of the city, and we couldn't get anything, you know. And he was just a polite gentleman. They had a fantastic meal, and I think Emma was very young, the chef, so it'd be back in those late 80s. So he calls her the next morning. He says, Ella, it pains me that you're that upset with New Orleans. He said, first of all, couldn't have had more fun last night. Always loved the company and the food was fantastic. Then he says, nobody's traveled as much as I've seen so much in my life doing what I do. He said, and I want to tell you this. When I go to Italy, nothing works. They're on strike. Everything's off time. He says, but Italians, they do something better than any. They live life. They're daily cultures, they live life. He says, anywhere else I travel, certainly in America, there's only one other place that I can say the local people live life. He says, it's New Orleans. Y'all live life. He says, get over all the stuff not working. So here I'm the next generation, and I've already said I want my city to be great. You know, I want it to be perfectly clean and everything working and all that stuff. But when I think of that, it helps me get over my love-hate relationship where I'm like disappointed we're not doing something better, because that man was right. I mean, we really connect with each other all day long, and we live life.
So we have arrived at the end of this interview. We hope that you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, and I hope that you also had someone bring you po' boys.
Oh, yes.
In the middle of it. Or that maybe you went and got a po' boy first. Oh, we should have put like a po' boy warning at the top of the episode.
We should. Rookie mistake. Yeah. Rookie mistake. When we first get back from these trips, we have these massive, we get transcripts of everything, and we have this big document where we just put in quotes that we like. And I remember for some interviews, it ends up being the whole interview. And you eventually have to
go like, well, we can't use everything.
Yes.
So yeah, I think he was one of the ones who made it into a lot of episodes, but I really get a kick out of just kind of going through the whole thing. So I hope y'all also feel the same way.
I hope so too. And I also hope that you'll reach out.
Yeah.
You contact us.
Uh-huh.
You can email us. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us at SaverPod at Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. We do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thank you, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.